This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Dangerous Lies by Becca Fitzpatrick, read by Madeline Mabee.
An angry rap shook the motel room door. I lay perfectly still on the mattress, my skin hot and clammy. Beside me, Reed drew my body to his. So much for 10 minutes, I thought. I tried not to cry as I nestled my face into the warm curve of Reed's neck. My mind absorbed every detail, carefully retaining this moment so I could play it back for a long, long time after they took me away. I had a wild impulse to flee with him. An alley flanked the motel, visible from the room they kept me in. Details like where we would hide and how we'd keep from ending up at the bottom of the Delaware River with cement blocks strapped to our feet kept me from acting on that impulse. The knock grew louder. Bending his head close to mine, Reed breathed deeply. He was trying to remember me, too.
"The room is probably bugged."
He spoke so softly I almost mistook the sound for a sigh.
"Have they told you where they're taking you?"
I shook my head from side to side, and his face, which was crisscrossed with cuts and swollen at the cheekbones, fell.
"Yeah, me neither."
Because his body was also bruised, he rolled gingerly onto his knees, searching along the headboard. He opened the nightstand drawer and fanned the pages of the Gideon Bible. He looked under the mattress. Nothing. But of course they'd bugged the room. They didn't trust us not to talk about that night, even though my testimony was the last thing on my mind. After everything I'd agreed to do for them, they couldn't give me 10 minutes, 10 private minutes, with my boyfriend before they dragged us apart?
"Are you mad at me?"
I couldn't help whispering. He was in this mess because of me. Because of my mom. It was trouble with her that had effectively ruined his life and future. How could he not resent me even a little? His hesitation made me feel a deep, limitless anger toward my mom. Then he said,
"Don't."
Softly but firmly.
"Don't say that. Nothing's changed. We're going to be together. Not now, but soon."
My relief came quick and sure. I shouldn't have doubted him. Reed was the one. He loved me and had proven once again that I could count on him. A key scraped the lock.
"Don't forget the Phillies account," Reed whispered urgently in my ear.
I met his eyes. In the seconds that followed, we shared an unspoken conversation. With one slight nod, I told him I understood. Then I threw my arms around him so tightly I heard the breath go out of him. I released him just as Deputy Marshal Price thrust open the door. 2 black Buick sedans idled in the parking lot behind him. He glanced between us.
"Time to go."
A second deputy, one I didn't recognize, led Reed out. With one backward glance, Reed held me in his gaze. He tried to smile, but only one side of his mouth turned up. He was nervous. My heart began to pound. This was it. Last chance to run. "Reed," I called out, but he was already inside the car. I couldn't see his face behind the tinted glass. The car turned out of the lot and accelerated. 10 seconds later, I'd lost sight of it. That's when my heart really started to pound. This was actually happening. I squeezed my suitcase handle hard between my fingers. I wasn't ready. I couldn't leave the only place I knew. My friends, my house, my school. And Reed?
"First step's always the hardest," Deputy Marshal Price said, coaxing me outside by the elbow. "Look at it this way. You get to start life fresh, reinvent yourself. Don't think about the trial now. You won't have to see Danny Bolando for months, maybe years. His attorneys will tie this case up in knots. I've seen the defense delay trial with excuses ranging from a lost easy pass to traffic on the Schuylkill Expressway.
Delay? I echoed.
Delays lead to acquittals. General rule. But not this time. With your testimony, Danny Bilondo is going to prison. He squeezed my shoulder with conviction. The jury will believe you. He's facing life without parole, and it's going to stick.
He'll stay in jail through the trial? I asked uneasily.
Held without bail. He can't get to you.
Holed up in a safe house for the past 72 hours while I waited for my mother's drug dealer to be arraigned on a first-degree murder charge and multiple counts of drug possession and trafficking, I'd felt like a prisoner. The last 3 days, a pair of U.S. Marshals had guarded me at all times. 2 in the morning, another set during the day, and 2 more for the night shift. I was not allowed to either make or receive phone calls. All electronics had been confiscated. I was provided a wardrobe of ill-matching pieces a deputy had grabbed from my closet at home. And now, as a key witness in a federal criminal case that was going to trial, since Danny Bilondo had pleaded not guilty to the charges, I was about to be transferred to my final penitentiary. Whereabouts? Unknown.
Where are you taking me? I asked.
Price cleared his throat.
Thunder Basin, Nebraska.
There was the faintest note of apology in his tone, which told me all I needed to know. It was a crap deal. I was helping them put away a dangerous criminal, and in return, they were banishing me from civilization.
And Reed? You know I can't tell you where he's going.
He's my boyfriend.
This is how we keep witnesses safe. I know it isn't easy on you, but we're doing our job. Got you the 10 minutes you asked for. Had to jump through a lot of hoops. Last thing the judge wants is for one of you to influence the other's testimony.
I was being forced to leave my boyfriend, and he wanted a thank you?
What about my mom? Straightforward, no emotion. Price rolled my suitcase to the rear of the Buick, carefully avoiding my eyes.
Headed to rehab. I can't tell you where, but if she works hard, she'll be ready to join you at the end of summer.
We both know I don't want that, so let's not play this game.
Wisely, Price let it drop.
It wasn't dawn yet, and I was already hot and sticky in my shorts and tank. I wondered how Price could be comfortable in jeans and a long-sleeved shirt. I didn't look at the gun in the holster over his shoulder, but I felt its presence. It was a reminder that the danger wasn't over. I wasn't sure it ever would be. Danny Bilondo wouldn't stop searching for me. He was in jail, but the rest of his drug cartel was roaming free. Any one of them could be paid to do his bidding. His only hope was to hunt me down and kill me before I could testify. Price and I slipped into the Buick, and he handed me a passport with a name that wasn't mine.
You can't come back, Stella. Not ever.
I touched my fingertips to the window. As we drove out of Philadelphia in the pre-dawn hours, we passed a bakery. A boy in an apron ran a broom across the doorstep. I thought he might glance up and pause to watch me until I was out of sight, but he kept at his work. No one knew I was leaving. That was the point. The streets were empty and shiny black with fresh rain. I listened to the water rush under the tires and tried not to lose it completely. This was home. This was the only place I knew. Leaving it felt like giving up something as vital as air. Suddenly, I asked myself if I could do this.
My name's not Stella, I finally said.
Normally, we let witnesses keep their first name, but yours is unusual, Price explained. We're taking an extra precaution. Your old and new names sound similar, which should help you adjust.
Stella Gordon. Stella, Stella, Stella.
I repeated the new name in my head until the syllables locked together. I hated the name. The Buick sped up, merging onto the interstate. Soon I saw signs for the airport, and at that moment a fierce ache gripped my chest. My flight left in 4 hours. I was having a hard time breathing. The air refused to go in.
It pushed down on me like something solid. I wiped my palms on my thighs. This didn't feel like a new beginning. I craned my neck to keep the lights of Philly in view. As the car left them in the distance, I felt like my life was coming to an end. Sunlight stretched across the Nebraska miles, burning fiery pink gold through a bank of clouds on the horizon. It was almost sunset, and the land spread out, an expanse of never-ending cornfields broken only by the rising silhouette of a windmill or grain silo. Gone were the sleek skyscrapers glittering with lights, the historic brick storefronts of the main line patched with colorful advertisements, and the lush manicured gardens and winding roads of the suburbs. No rush of people bustling to catch the subway downtown or car horns blaring a cacophony of staccato blasts as traffic thickened. Deputy Price and I passed cattle grazing along the barren highway, swishing flies with their tails, a few raising their large triangular heads to gaze curiously in our direction, making me wonder when they'd last seen a car. I cracked the window. The air smelled green and alive and foreign as it whistled inside. Three shirtless boys, skinny as broomsticks, walked barefoot along the highway, fishing poles balanced over their sunburned shoulders. I could hear my best friend Tori Bell's voice in my head. "They've sent you into Children of the Corn. Forget about Italian drug lords. I give you 24 hours in this place." Price said, "School's out. All summer to do what you please. You lucked out." "Lucky me," I echoed. "You'll be safe here." He waited for my response, but we both knew I wasn't safe. Every morning I would wake up wondering if today Danny would find me. "You'll be living with Carmina Songster, retired cop, very capable. She knows the truth about you, and she'll be living your cover story." "What if I don't like her?" "Everyone loves Carmina. They call her Gran. The whole town calls her Gran."
"And she's going to protect me?"
Price turned his head, leveling his Ray-Ban-shaded eyes with mine. "Some friendly advice? How this summer plays out is up to you. Could be a miserable one, or a tolerable one. Hell, it might even be better than tolerable. I know you're angry at your mom." I stiffened. "Don't bring her into this." "Carmina can call her when you're ready. She has the clinic's number." I fixed him with a meaningful, icy glare. "I said I don't want to talk about her." "You've got a right to feel betrayed and hurt, but your mom is going to get better. I really believe that. You can't give up on her now. She needs you more than ever."
"What about when I needed her?" I snapped. "I stopped holding my breath for her to get better a long time ago. She's the reason I'm here, not home with my friends in a world that actually makes sense."
My breath caught in the back of my throat. Price held his tongue several minutes before saying,
"After I introduce you to Carmina, I have to head back. But she knows how to reach me. Call me anytime."
"She is not my family. You are not my family. So let's not play this game either."
He grew very still, and I knew my remark had stung. He was putting his life on the line to protect me. The least I could do was show a little gratitude. But I'd told the truth. I was a job to him. We weren't family. I didn't have a family. I had an estranged father who'd turned down the U.S. attorney's offer to place him in WITSEC with me. I was never to contact him again. And I had a mother in rehab who I hoped I never saw again. Family implied love, commitment, a sense of solidarity. At the very least, it implied living together. We rode the rest of the way in silence. I shifted away from Price, watching the sun melt below the horizon. I'd never known the sun could take up so much space. Out here, without buildings or woods or hills to block the view, the sun wasn't merely a sphere. It seemed to spread like shimmering gold liquid, a fat brushstroke of paint on the skyline. It was as dazzling as it was alien.
After dark, Price turned onto a rural road. Plumes of dust clouded the windows. I jostled in my seat as the tires bounced over potholes. Towering, gnarled cottonwood trees framed the road, and I briefly wondered what it would feel like to climb their thick, sloping branches all the way to the top. As a little girl, I had dreamed of having my own treehouse with a tire swing. But I was too old to wish for those things now. I could just make out the silhouette of a two-story house. It had the biggest lawn I'd ever seen, with more cottonwood trees soaring over the roofline. The lawn gave way to open fields, and past those I could see nothing but a sapphire sky powdered with stars. It was almost overwhelming, the sheer vastness of it all. I felt completely alone. I had traveled to the edge of the world. There was nothing beyond this place. A few steps farther and I might drop over the end of the earth. Unnerved by the thought, I cracked my window again for fresh air, but the breeze was sticky and humid. Night insects droned in a soft, monotonous rhythm. It was an eerie, empty quiet, unlike anything I had ever heard. Suddenly, I longed for the familiar sounds of home. I would never get used to this place. Price slowed at the mailbox, checking the number against the document in his hand. Having confirmed we had the right house, he pulled into the driveway of a stately white clapboard farmhouse. The house had a porch on both the main and second levels, two white railings running the entire width of the facade. A large American flag hung down from the second level and rippled gently in the breeze. Several smaller flags staked into the lawn created a pathway from the porch steps to the driveway running alongside the house. Bunches of colorful flowers bloomed from whiskey barrels at the top of the drive.
"We made it," Price said, turning off the engine.
He popped the trunk where my suitcase waited. I knew I had to get out of the car, but my legs wouldn't move. I stared up at the house, unable to picture myself inside it. I thought of my real home. Last year as a birthday gift, or, more accurately, to apologize for failing to register me for driver's ed because she was too busy getting high, and the timing had just happened to work out nicely, my mom had hired a decorator to refinish my bedroom. I got to pick everything. White-painted bookshelves, a vintage chandelier, Tiffany blue walls, and a Victorian mahogany desk we'd bought on our last trip to New York. My diary was still locked inside the top drawer. My life was back there. Everything was back there. As we climbed out of the car, a woman rose from the porch swing and descended the steps, the heels of her red cowboy boots coming down hard on the weathered wood.
"You found the place," she called out.
She wore jeans tucked into the boots and a denim shirt with a few buttons open at the top. Her platinum white hair hit just above the shoulders, and she studied us with snapping blue eyes.
"Just enjoying a glass of lemonade and listening to the cicadas. Can I offer you a drink?" "Now that's an offer I can't refuse," Price said. "Stella?"
I glanced between them. They watched me with careful, braced smiles. Feeling my head begin to spin, I blinked a few times, trying to right the world. The woman's red boots began to swirl like a kaleidoscope, and I knew I'd lost the fight. Suddenly, I was back in Philadelphia, a man bleeding out on the floor of our library, human tissue splattered on the wall behind him. I felt the weight of my mom's head cradled in my lap, strange hysterical sobs breaking from my throat. I heard police sirens wailing up the street and my own pulse roaring in my ears.
"Perhaps you'd like me to show you to your room, Stella," the woman said, jerking me out of the flashback.
I felt myself sway, and Price caught me by the elbow.
"Let's get her inside. Long day of travel. A full night's rest will do a world of good."
Regaining some of my senses, I ripped out of his hold.
"Don't." "Stella."
I whirled on him. "What do you want from me? Do you want me to drink lemonade and act like any of this is normal? I don't want to be here. I didn't ask for this. Everything I know is gone. I'll never forgive her for this." The words came choking out before I realized it.
My whole body felt tight and slippery. I swiped at my eyes, refusing to cry. Not until I was alone and could risk falling apart. I pressed my fingernails deep into my palm to draw the pain out of my heart and focus it somewhere manageable. Before I dragged my luggage up to the house, I saw the woman's, Carmina's, mouth pinch at the edges, and Price flashed her an apologetic grimace as if to say there was no accounting for teenage behavior. I didn't care what they thought. If they believed I was selfish and difficult, they were probably right. And if I made this summer a living hell for Carmina, maybe she'd let me move out early and live on my own. It wasn't the worst idea I'd ever had. Price trotted up the porch steps to hold the screen door for me, and Carmina said, "Maybe we'll put off a tour of the house until tomorrow. Bed might be just the thing."
"I can't be the only one who's dog-tired," Price readily agreed.
I wasn't tired, but I wanted to close myself behind a door just as badly as they did, so I didn't argue. I didn't care if it made me look compliant.
Carmina would find out soon enough that even though the Justice Department had given me a cover story and a new life, I wasn't going to pretend like anything about this was okay with me. Inside, the house smelled like rose water. Dainty flower-printed wallpaper peeled away from the walls, and I caught a glimpse of the sofas in the living room, battered blue corduroy. There was an antlered head of some species of deer mounted above the fireplace. I'd never seen anything so backwoods or tacky.
Carmina led the way up the worn staircase. Nail holes pitted the wall going up, but the portraits had been taken down. And for the first time, I wondered briefly about Carmina. Who she was, why she lived alone, if she'd had a family and what had happened to them. Instantly, I shut off the questions. This woman meant nothing to me. She was a government-issued stand-in for my mom until I turned 18 at the end of August and could legally live on my own. At the top of the stairs, Carmina pushed open a door.
"This is where you'll sleep. Fresh towels on the dresser, basic toiletries in the bathroom next door down. Tomorrow we can swing by the store and pick up anything I missed. Breakfast's at 7 sharp. Any dietary restrictions I need to know about? Not allergic to peanuts, are you?"
"No." She gave a satisfied nod.
"See you in the morning, then. Sleep tight."
Carmina closed the door, and I lowered myself onto the edge of the twin bed. The springs squeaked an off-key note. The window was open, letting in a warm, muggy breeze, and I wondered why Carmina wasn't running the AC. She wasn't going to leave the house windows open all night, was she? Was that safe? I shut and locked the window and yanked the blue cotton curtains shut, but right away the hot, stuffy air felt suffocating. I lifted my hair to fan the back of my neck. Then I peeled out of my clothes and flopped back on the bed. The room was small, barely wide enough to hold the bed and an oak dresser. The pitched roof made the walls seem to squeeze even tighter around me. My eyes traced the patchwork of blue rectangles on the faded ceiling where posters, now gone, had preserved the original paint color. Blue paint, blue curtains, blue sheets, and a dusty baseball glove on the top shelf of the open closet. A boy must have lived here. I wondered where he'd gone.
Somewhere far away, surely. As soon as I turned 18, I was going far away from this place, too.
Reaching into the front pouch of my suitcase, I pulled out a small bundle of letters. Contraband. I wasn't supposed to bring anything from my old life, any proof that I had come from Philadelphia, and I felt a thrill at this small rebellion, accidental as it was. Call me sentimental, but lately I'd been carrying Reed's letters with me everywhere. The more unstable my home life had become, the more comforting I'd found them. When I felt alone, they reminded me that I had Reed. He cared about me. He had my back. Up until 3 nights ago, I'd stored the letters in my purse. I'd moved them to my suitcase to keep them from being discovered. Some of the letters were recent, but others were from as long ago as 2 years, when Reed and I first started dating. Vowing to ration them, I took one from the top and returned the others to their hiding place.
Estella, don't know if you've ever had someone leave a note under your windshield wiper, but it seemed like the kind of thing you'd find romantic. Remember that night on the train, when we first met? I never told you, but I took a candid picture of you. It was before you left your phone on your seat and I chased you down to give it back, hero that I am. Anyway, I was pretending to text so you wouldn't know I took your picture. I still have it on my phone. I love you. Now do me a favor and destroy this so I can keep my dignity intact. Read. I pressed the letter to my chest, feeling my breathing slow. Please let me see him again soon, I silently begged. I didn't know how long the letters would tide me over. But tonight's letter had done its job. The loneliness drained from my body, leaving a deep physical exhaustion. I rolled onto my side, expecting sleep to come quickly. Instead, I grew more aware of the quiet stillness. It was an empty sound, waiting to be filled. My imagination wasted no time inventing explanations for the soft creak of the walls, shrinking as the day's heat wore off, or the occasional thud on the floorboards. I couldn't shake the picture of Danny Bilondo's dark eyes as I slipped into restless sleep. The rumble of a lawnmower carried through the bedroom window, which I'd opened in the middle of the night after waking dizzy with heat and bathed in sweat. The whine of the engine grew nearer, passing right under the window, then droned to the far edge of the lawn. I cracked one bleary eye and found the clock on the nightstand. Annoyance and outrage shot through me. Kicking free of the sheets, I stuck my head out the window and shouted, "Hey, check the time!" The guy pushing the mower didn't hear me. I slammed the rickety window shut. It muffled the noise, fractionally. I flipped the guy off. He didn't see it. The first rays of dawn were behind him, illuminating thousands of specks of pollen and gnats buzzing around his head like a halo as he pushed the mower across Carmina's yard. The toes of his boots were stained green from the grass, and he wore a tan cowboy hat low over his eyes. He had earbuds in, and I watched his lips move to the lyrics of a song. I dropped a nightshirt over my head and stepped into the hall. "Carmina?" I padded to the end of the hall and knocked on her bedroom door. The door cracked.
"What is it? What's the matter?"
It was so dark in her room I couldn't make out her face, but I heard the anxiety in her voice and could hear her fumbling for something, clothes most likely, on the floor. "Someone's mowing your yard." She dropped the clothes and straightened.
"And?"
"It's only 5.
"You woke me up to tell me the time?"
"I can't sleep. It's too loud." Her mattress springs creaked as she settled back into bed. She let out a sigh of exasperation.
"Chet Falconer. Lives down the road. Wants to finish work before it's too hot. Good for him. Don't you have one of those little music gadgets? Turn on a song and you won't hear a thing."
"I wasn't allowed to bring my iPhone."
"An iPhone isn't the only thing round here that plays music. Try the bottom drawer of the dresser in your room. Now go back to bed, Stella."
She leaned out of bed and pushed the door closed in my face. My back went up and I walked stiffly to my room. I cast an evil eye out the window, watching as Chet Falconer finished another row and swung the mower around. From this angle, I couldn't see his face, but a small patch of sweat soaked through the front of his white t-shirt, and when he paused to wipe his cheek on his sleeve, the hem of his shirt hitched up, revealing a taut stomach. His arms were tan and muscular, and he tapped his thumb against the mower's handlebar to keep time with whatever music he was listening to. He'd obviously started the morning with an entire pot of coffee. Since I couldn't say the same, I just scowled at him. I was tempted to open the window and yell down something obscene, but between the earbuds and the mower, there was no way he'd hear. I sprawled face down on the bed and folded the pillow tightly over my head. No luck. The lawnmower continued to whine through the windowpane like an angry insect. Taking Carmina's advice, I jerked open the bottom drawer of the dresser and nearly choked on my laughter. A Sony Walkman, complete with AM/FM radio and cassette player. I blew dust off the surface, thinking I hadn't traveled to Nebraska, I'd traveled into the previous century. Sorting through the cassette tapes littering the bottom of the drawer, I read the handwritten labels. Poison, Whitesnake, Van Halen, Metallica. Did Carmina have a son? Had this been his bedroom before he'd bolted, wisely, out of Thunder Basin? I chose Van Halen because it was the only tape that didn't need to be rewound. Hitting play, I snuggled under the sheet and turned up the volume until I could no longer hear the rumble of Chet Falconer's lawnmower. I wandered down to the kitchen at 10. I followed the smell of bacon and eggs to find my way. I couldn't remember the last time I'd had bacon and eggs. Disneyland, probably, when I was 7, with Mickey Mouse-shaped pancakes. The idea of eating a meal at a table set with real dishes, let alone having someone cook for me, was unfathomable. My go-to breakfast was a skinny latte and whole grain oatmeal from Starbucks. I ate in my car on the way to school. As I entered the kitchen, I found the table cleared and the food gone. Through the screen door leading to the backyard, I could see Carmina on her knees in the vegetable garden, pulling weeds. Judging by the large pile beside her, she'd been out there a while. "I think I missed breakfast," I said, crossing the yard to her. "Think so," she said without looking up. "Did you save any for me?" "Last I checked, bacon and eggs don't taste good cold." "Okay, I get it. You snooze, you lose," I said with a shrug. If she thought she was going to make a point by starving me, she was pretty inexperienced at parenthood. I could do just fine on a mug of coffee. Wouldn't be the first time. "When's lunch?" "After we drive you around to fill out summer job applications." "I don't want a job." "School's out, so most of the good jobs have been snatched up, but we'll find you something," she went on. "I don't want a job," I repeated more firmly. I'd never had a job. My family wasn't old money, we didn't live in a country estate on the main line, and I didn't dress effortlessly like Jackie O. But we weren't living paycheck to paycheck, either. My mom had been a debutante in Knoxville, and while she'd burned through what could be called her dowry, it was important to her to keep up appearances. It just would not do to have me seen in the workforce. My dad was a principal in a venture capital firm, and after he divorced my mom more than 2 years ago, he left her with enough money that she didn't have to work. Up until a few days ago, I'd lived with my mom in the suburbs, in a beautiful gray fieldstone cottage that sat at the end of a long, tree-lined cul-de-sac. Circumstances as they were, I'd never had the motivation or desire to break a sweat for minimum wage. And I definitely wasn't used to taking orders. My mom was more like a roommate than a parent. We were often ships passing in the night. I hadn't had someone tell me what to do in years. Carmina sat back on her haunches and looked at me squarely. "What are you gonna do all summer, child? Sit around and feel sorry for yourself? Not under my roof. Time a girl your age learned to look after herself." I ran my tongue over my teeth, checking my words. If Carmina wanted a fight, I could give her one. But if she, an adult, was baiting me into a fight, it stood to reason that she had an agenda. Maybe she thought if I could just yell and scream and get all my pain out in the open, I'd suddenly become a new person. One who wanted to be in Thunder Basin for the summer. One who wanted to make Carmina's life easy. "All right," I said, forcing myself to speak calmly. "What kind of job do you think I can get?" Carmina frowned, proving I'd guessed right. She'd expected me to fight back, to let my anger out. She'd hoped I would. I had news for her. The cop had lost her edge in retirement. She couldn't read me, and I couldn't think of a bigger victory.
Well, she said thoughtfully at last, there's food service. I hear the Sundown Diner is hiring car hops. Or you could work in the cornfields. They're always looking for help. But it's hard, hot work with long hours, and the pay isn't anything to smile about.
Okay, I said, still cool and collected. I'll take a shower and get ready. By the time I'd climbed the stairs to my room, I'd changed my mind about the job. I'd probably hate it, but it couldn't be worse than sitting around the house all day with Carmina. And since I got the feeling she expected me, a bratty teen with an attitude problem, to fail at manual labor, I was invested in proving her wrong. How hard could a summer job be? Flipping burgers was gross, but hardly rocket science. And if I got the diner job, it would have air conditioning. Surely Nebraska had embraced that modern convenience. I found it a touch ironic that I, the proverbial princess from the castle high on the hill, was being forced to take the disguise I least wanted, that of a poor, hard-working servant girl. I wondered if Deputy Price and the rest of his friends at the DOJ had planned this, to give me a heaping spoonful of humble pie. They probably found it amusing. Go ahead, boys. Laugh all you want. When this is over, you'll still be wearing cheap suits and dealing with the scum of the earth. Meanwhile, the government will have to unfreeze my family's accounts, I'll have my money back, and this humiliating summer will be nothing more than a distant memory. A half hour later, I emerged from the bathroom with damp hair and the cheap smell of ivory clinging to my skin. I wore cutoffs and a basic white tee. I'd skipped putting on makeup, except for a quick dab of tinted moisturizer and a swipe of lip gloss. Although it was so humid out, I hardly needed either. Carmina had moved her weed pulling to the front yard. She knelt over the flower bed at the bottom of the driveway, tossing weeds into a bucket. When the porch door slammed shut behind me, she looked up from beneath her wide-brimmed straw hat.
"What kind of job are you hoping for dressed like that?" she asked, rocking back on her heels to examine me. "Don't care?" "You don't care? You're gonna get stuck with the cards at the bottom of the deck. Somebody has to get them." "You've sure got the attitude down, don't you? Get in the truck, then." An old Ford truck with peeling blue paint was parked in the driveway, and after wrenching the heavy passenger door open, I climbed in. The insides of both doors were rusted over, and the seat covers had split open to reveal foam cushioning. The glove box lay open. I tried to shut it, but the securing mechanism must have been broken because the door flopped open in the same position I'd found it. I rolled my eyes and hoped the next surprise wouldn't be a rat darting across my foot. "Really hoping you loan me this clunker," I breathed cynically as Carmina hoisted herself behind the wheel. "Buy your own truck. That's what a paycheck's for." She pumped the gas pedal, cranked the ignition, and the engine growled to life. "Bought this truck working my first job. Felt good to be an independent woman. Wouldn't dream of robbing you of the same satisfaction." "What year's the truck?"
'79.
I whistled. "You're older than I thought."
"That's what you think?" She laughed long and heartily. "Girl, didn't anybody tell you you're only as old as you feel? Judging by your long, sour face, I'm not the one who's got something to worry about."
As we drove down the gravel road that led to the paved street that would eventually take us into town, we passed a two-story red brick house shaded by a grove of cottonwood trees. There were hanging flower pots on the porch, and the architecture had the charm of, and potential for, a country bed and breakfast. At that moment, Chet Falconer rounded the side of the house carrying a rusted toolbox in one hand and a ladder in the other. I still couldn't see his face, but I recognized the low-tipped cowboy hat and white t-shirt. "How old is he?" I asked.
19.
After a beat, Carmina's eyes darted to mine as if she'd suddenly perceived something important.
"Oh, no, you don't. Don't you get any ideas. That boy has enough trouble. What kind of trouble?
There's only one kind of trouble, the kind you stay away from. Carmina said it in a way that let me know she wasn't going to give away more, no matter how hard I pressed.
Fine by me. I could be patient.
What she probably didn't realize was that in telling me nothing, she'd made certain I would dig deeper into our resident man of mystery.
I watched Chet's arms flex as he hoisted the toolbox onto the porch and braced the ladder against the side of the house. One thing was for sure. He had a nice body. Maybe country boys knew how to work it.
He does a lot of home maintenance for a 19-year-old, I said. His parents must be slave drivers.
Carmina cast me a disapproving look.
His parents are dead. He's man of the house. If he doesn't take care of the place, no one will.
I couldn't believe he had the entire house to himself. In 3 months, I could be like him. Living alone in the city of my choice. I couldn't go back to Philly, but there were other places I liked. Boston was at the top of the list.
Where's he going to college in the fall?
He isn't.
He's going to stay here in Thunder Basin and mow lawns for the rest of his life?
Her eyes broke from the road to meet mine. I saw a flash of something in them. Anger, sorrow, a glimmer of pain.
Problem with that? She said coolly.
Yes, it's a loser thing to do. He should get as far away from this place as possible and get a real life, a real job.
Carmina didn't answer, just kept her gaze forward. But I knew she'd understood my insult perfectly. Being a cop in a sleepy town like Thunder Basin wasn't a real way of life. But the fact that she sat there and took the snub with nothing more than a resolute upward tilt of her chin made me somehow feel like she'd won this round. We spent the next 2 hours popping in and out of fast food joints and greasy diners dotting the 7 blocks that made up Thunder Basin's downtown. Most of the buildings were either red brick or whitewashed cinder block. A bulbous water tower and a few grain silos made up the rest of the cityscape. Nailed to one storefront was a handmade sign that read, Haircuts, $7.50 owed.
The tip alone on my usual cut is 3 times that, I thought dryly.
I filled out an application at every restaurant, leaving it with the manager. I gave my fake name and my fake social security number, which matched the details in my fake passport. Carmina helped me fill out the address and phone number where I could be reached. I checked the boxes for waitress, dishwasher, and hostess. I didn't care what job they gave me. I'd hate them all. I'd spend the next 3 months doing what I had to, and then I was out of here.
On the ride back, Carmina said,
Anything strike your fancy?
I stared out the window at the haze of green rushing past in a blur. There was no rise and fall of the road. No hills to be climbed or valleys to dip into. The road was a straight shot, with tidy rows of plants walling me in on either side and a dome of blue trapping me from overhead. I felt like an ant under a glass, hot, hopeless, doomed.
Nope. You should have put on slacks and a blouse.
Nobody calls them slacks anymore.
They make a better impression than hacked-off jeans that show half your leg.
I ran my fingers seductively up my thigh.
More than half, Carmina. A lot more than half.
Besides, I'm not trying to impress anyone. She turned to face me, eyes widening theatrically.
You don't say.
After dinner, Carmina went to Bible study. I was left at the house, stuck. I didn't have a car. I could only travel as far as my own 2 feet saw fit. It occurred to me that if I did get a job, Carmina would have to provide me with transportation. It wasn't like I could walk the 5 miles into town and back. At this point, I'd be happy with a bike. More and more, I was becoming convinced that being employed wasn't such a bad way to pass the summer.
I watched Carmina's truck bounce down the gravel road leading away from the farmhouse. Dropping the curtain in my bedroom window, I headed downstairs to watch TV. If nothing else, it would be cooler on the main level. After TV, I could sit on the porch swing, lick a popsicle, and listen to the coyotes, because there definitely wasn't anything else to do. I climbed down the flight of stairs, and just like that, I was tumbling down into the past. The traumatic flashbacks were stronger than memories. I wasn't blacking out. I was conscious. But the flashbacks eclipsed my real vision. They felt very real. And they always began in the same way. It was after midnight. I'd broken curfew again. Not wanting to risk waking my mom, who was I kidding? She was probably passed out. I parked my car one house down from our gray fieldstone. Oddly, there was a white Honda Civic already parked on the curb. The fogs never left cars on the street, and they didn't drive a Honda Civic. Shrugging off the oddity, I hurried around the side of the house, rooting in my bag for keys. As I crept up the back steps, I could smell our boxwood gardens and the newly blossomed trees. Even though I made it a point to never be home and to avoid my mom when I was, I loved our house, especially the yard. It was my favorite escape. Lounging in the gardens, hidden in the shade of old trees, I daydreamed to music by Ben Howard, the Oh Hellos, or Boy. I let myself in. The kitchen light didn't turn on, nor did the dining room chandelier. It never occurred to me that something might be wrong. I assumed my mom had forgotten to replace the bulbs. In the dark, I felt my way toward the staircase. My footsteps were light and quick. If I was lucky, I could avoid my mom until morning. As I crossed in front of the library's beveled glass doors, I saw her slumped in one of the leather wingback chairs. Moonlight filtered through the shutters, casting her in a waxy white light. Her party favors were spread on the side table, a colorful concoction of pills. I started to feel disgust. And then, my eyes were drawn to the shadows behind her. I stared at the man's crumpled body in a daze. His limbs were sprawled in funny, permanent angles. I walked closer. I didn't want to, but I couldn't stop. I walked until I stood over him, his vacant brown eyes staring up at me. A neat hole was blown through his forehead. I came out of the flashback panting. I fumbled for the switch at the bottom of Carmina's staircase, relieved when light immediately chased away the darkness. The dead man was in a casket 6 feet below grass, and Danny Belando was in jail. He couldn't hurt me. My steps to Thunder Basin had been erased. He'd never find Stella Gordon. With a hollow shiver, I climbed upstairs and pulled one of Reed's letters from my suitcase. I needed him here with me, reassuring me everything was going to be okay. But tonight I would have to settle for his words. It was infuriating that the Justice Department could rip us apart. They were making it possible for me to be with my mom again, so why not Reed? If I'd had a say, I would have chosen to live with him. It wouldn't have even been a choice. Estella, I got in a fight with my dad tonight. It was bad. Now that I'm 17, he's pushing me to enlist. I've been telling him for years that I'm not following in his footsteps, but he refuses to hear. I came to your house to spend the night, but you're not here and you're not answering your phone. Call me when you get this. I hope it doesn't bother you that I come over all the time. I hate being at my place. When I'm there, my dad won't leave me alone. After our fight, he told me if I left, he wouldn't let me back in. Well, I left. I don't know what's going to happen now. I used to wish my mom would stand up to him, but she never will. She always retreats, hiding out in bed, using her fibromyalgia as an excuse to not get involved. It's a disease. But it's also her coping mechanism. If she has it to deal with, she doesn't have to deal with us. I wish I had enough money to get my own place. Someday I will. And I'll take you with me. Reed. It hurt to remember our plans. We were going to run away and start a new life together. Now I didn't know if I'd see him again. He could be in Kentucky or Kansas. I'd never know, unless I went looking for him. And I could go looking, because I knew how to find him. Deputy Price had made it very clear that I should never, under any circumstances, attempt to contact anyone from my old life. Danny Bilondo and the dangerous men he employed would never give up looking for me. The only way they'd find me was if I broke the rules. I knew contacting Reed was breaking the rules, but he wasn't in Philly anymore. He was in WITSEC, Witness Protection. His ties to the city had been erased, and if the U.S. Marshals had done half as good a job making him vanish as they had me, I wasn't going to tip off Danny Bilondo's men to my location by contacting Reed. I hadn't seen a computer in Carmina's house, and I wouldn't have used it anyway. If I went through with this, I couldn't leave a trail. Earlier, in town, I'd seen signs for the public library. It was too far to walk there tonight, but I was guessing Carmina stored a bike somewhere in that weathered barn behind her house. I didn't know how long Bible study lasted, but it was safe to assume I had at least an hour. Swatting mosquitoes as I jogged across the backyard, I swung open the barn doors and glanced around the cavernous space. The air smelled of mildew and hay. And gasoline. I was pretty sure the gasoline smell came from the large automobile hidden under a canvas cover at the back of the barn. I lifted the canvas and saw that Carmina was keeping an old Ford Mustang on hand. The paint was an ugly shade of brown, and there were a handful of dead hornets on the dash. But I wasn't feeling picky. What were the odds I could get it to start? Carmina had left the keys on the driver's seat, which made finding out a whole lot easier. After a few tries, the Mustang's engine grumbled to life, and the smell of burning oil filled the air. Carmina had forbidden me from borrowing her truck, but she'd never told me I couldn't drive the Mustang. I knew the way into town. It was a straight shot once I turned onto the paved street at the end of Carmina's gravel road. In town, I found the library easily. There were only three other cars in the parking lot, so I had my pick of stalls. It felt strange not to circle the lot and drive the surrounding streets multiple times, hunting for a space. Back home, I rarely drove into the city for that reason alone. It was far more convenient to take a train. At the front desk, I applied for a library card. After checking my passport photo and address, the librarian gave me a temporary card. My real card would arrive in the mail within 2 weeks. Carmina wouldn't suspect anything. I'd tell her I liked to read, which wasn't a lie. I found a vacant computer and logged onto the internet. Soon after Reed and I had started dating, he set up a private email address that we both had access to. Instead of emailing each other, we wrote drafts for the other person to find. Each draft got deleted after it was read. Reed had read an article about spies using the technique, and while I thought it was a little over the top, I didn't argue. His dad was military. Army. Your upbringing shaped you. We'd used the email regularly at first, and then totally forgot about it. With a few quick keystrokes, I signed in to the private email, phillies60@gmail.com. The drafts folder was empty. I tried not to feel deflated. I'd expected to find a new message, especially since he'd reminded me about the secret email account yesterday morning before we left the motel. Wanting to let him know I was okay, I typed a brief email. Arrived safe and sound. Well, maybe not the last part. You should see this place. I'd almost rather be dead. Miss you. Let me know you're okay. I read over the words carefully, double-checking that they were too bland to pose any threat to me, on the wild chance anyone intercepted them. Then typed a quick P.S. P.S. They put my mom in detox. Now taking bets on how that will turn out. I saved the draft and logged out. I blew out some air. Time to be patient. A virtue I'd never loved, much less embraced. As I walked out of the library, the sky was black velvet and diamonds. In Philly, nighttime meant one thing, worrying about my mother, who she was with, what she was doing, and if I was going to have to go out and look for her. I stood still a moment, cautiously testing this new darkness. It was so quiet, so uncomplicated, so lovely. It seemed ridiculous to be afraid of it. The warm air tingled on my skin. It smelled fresh and greenly fragrant. The darkness offered relief from the high, hot sun that had stung my eyes all day. It painted the landscape in shadows. I could almost forget the cornfields and the blue, blue sky. I could almost forget I was here. The parking lot had one remaining car, Carmina's Mustang. I didn't know where the teens of Thunder Basin hung out after sundown, but the library obviously wasn't it. I would have cruised the 7 blocks of the main drag looking for signs of nightlife, but Carmina would likely be coming home from Bible study soon. She couldn't know what I'd done tonight. I turned the Mustang's ignition. The engine made a low chugging sound, but refused